And good evening, everybody. Welcome to Hoops HD's August session podcast. We are getting closer and closer to the start of the 2015-2016 college basketball season. And as we do during the offseason, we come to you once a month with a podcast, news, notes, and any other breaking information in the college basketball world. Let me start by introducing our esteemed panel for the evening. Myself, Chad Sherwood, coming to you live from the heart of Big Ten country here in southern New Jersey. And we also have with us, going from my right to left on the screen, it might not quite coincide with yours, but first we've got Kyle Lamb. Kyle, it's been a while since we've seen you on. How you doing?
Yeah, it's been a few months, Chad. How you guys been doing?
I'm kind of hanging in there. Kyle's going to have a big report for us in a minute here. We also have a new guest joining us tonight, John Titel. Hopefully I pronounced your last name right, John. I apologize if I did not. John, why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself? You're new to the program here.
Thanks for having me, Chad. You nailed the last name. I appreciate it and the chance to join you guys. Basically, went to college at Penn, went to grad school at Arizona, have enjoyed college basketball for the past 20 years. Love my Quakers, love my Wildcats, and hopefully we can stop playing Wisconsin in the Elite Eight sometime soon.
You're a Penn guy. I'm from, only about an hour out of Philly. I have a big five supporter myself, so we have some discussions as the season goes along about some big five basketball here, maybe. One of the best remaining rivalries out there in my
great
my opinion.
Well, yeah, all the rest of them are going away. We'll talk about that next month.
The other John joining us, John S., I guess we'll go with. John, how are you doing tonight?
Oh, I'm doing quite well. And now that our pro sports teams are starting to peter out here in the Cincinnati area, we're starting to look forward to college hoop season coming up in about 11 weeks.
And last and maybe least as well, David Griggs. David, how are you? And I guess you're under attack there. Is that what it says?
Hoops HD was under attack this week. Our server was bombarded and, like, it shut down. They were coming after us. But fortunately, Galen fought them off, and it's back up.
Looking into it, but the problem is David has made so many enemies, they don't know where to start.
Speaking of one of David's prime enemies here, Kyle, you just came back from visiting one of his key enemies, the NCAA.
I took a 3-day trip over to Indianapolis to visit the NCAA library, and I use the term library loosely because it's really not a library. It's just like a little section of the second floor in the NCAA headquarters that contains a bunch of their archives. So library is a very generous term, but it is basically a whole wing of the second floor that is just.
Wait a minute. You went to the library.
Yes, I went to
the library. And that's our top story. That's what we're leading on. Great show, Chad. Kyle goes to the library.
Well, you guys threw me off the show last month, so you had me on it as a picture. So, yeah, you get the library story.
Because I went to the library, and, of course, here at the NCAA headquarters, there is posters of David Griggs all over, asking security to please remove this man from the premises if he's seen.
Oh, yeah, because I'm always at the library.
In fact, sources close to the NCAA tell me that David Griggs is number two on the most wanted list behind the ghost of Jerry Tarkanian. Actually, the real Jerry Tarkanian was number one, but unfortunately he passed away, so the ghost shot up the list to number one.
So you mean that David Griggs is above Bobby Knight?
He is above Bobby Knight.
Wow.
But anyhow, yes, I visited the NCAA headquarters and I spent 3 days. Fortunately, they have like some wonderful research assistants over there. They've got like a total of 150 full-time employees. Four of them are actually just basically librarians and research assistants, and they were terrific to work with actually because from 9 a.m. until 5 p.m. The headquarters open every day, Monday through Friday. While I was there, basically they helped me find anything I needed. You know, specifically, I was looking through old, membership rolls and, convention minutes. And they also have these wonderful yearly basketball guides that they used to publish. And so, like, 3 days that I was there, I was going through, just mountains and mountains of data. And these research assistants really were, they were terrific. But it was an interesting experience. The NCAA headquarters is big and overwhelming as you would expect it to be. They've basically got, like, three different buildings. They've got, the corporate offices. They've got a second building, which is, for the NCAA museum. And then a third one is basically their corporate meeting rooms and secret places where you're not allowed to go with a guest pass like I had. If you go over to that wing, they'll quickly, shoo you away. It was a fun experience, though.
You do realize we're the most wanted cut in here now.
I think you could have even more echo there if we worked at it. Is that Charles Kosher? Today, I consider myself.
Toby's not here. Why are we still getting echoes?
Well, okay. Once again, we are a first-rate operation here. Well, first, let's just stick on this library issue here. Anyone have any other questions for Kyle about his journey?
Well, one of the things you're working on, Kyle, right, is this glamorous Hoops HD database, right, that you're working on.
Yeah, I've been working on it now for 5 years, but it's probably longer than 5 years, but I've been trying to work on putting together all-time participation lists of, like, every school that's ever fielded a basketball team at the college level. I'm working on, also, like, schedules. I've basically got all-time results for Division I. At some point, I'll be doing Division II and III at NAIA as well, but that's a little bit further down the road. So right now, I'm just working on membership lists. I've compiled an all-time NCAA membership list of member schools. I've done it for, the NCCA, National Christian College Athletic Association, actually puts one out every year anyway. I've got a NJCAA membership back in 1978, and I'm working on NAIA right now. I've got this database right now of schools, complete with, basically years participated, nicknames, colors. Right now the database is, I think, 3,100 schools at last check. And I'm fighting more JUCOs right now as we speak. I was working on that earlier this evening, actually.
So anything we ever want to know about Hiwassee College or Walla Walla University, coming soon to Hoops HD, it will all be here.
Well, I don't know about soon, but
it's coming. Yeah, at this rate, it's hard to say. Like, I keep saying this year, this year, this year, and, 5 years later, it's next year, next year.
Right.
While we're on the NCAA subject here, I'm going a little out of order of what we said we would, but we did have an announcement from the NCAA. David, I believe that you were able to track this down of who the new committee members will be for this year's NCAA Tournament Selection Committee. And David, why don't you go ahead and tell us who they are and why they're on the committee?
Well, I don't know why they're... I guess... Well, the way it works, it rolls around. It's conference representation. They're all 10 members are from different conferences, and they like to fluctuate it so it's half FBS, half non-FBS. The 10 FBS conferences now. The two new members are Jim Schaus from Ohio University and Kevin White from Duke. There has been a little being an under the radar guy like you. You would think we would be up in arms in this. I just really don't think it matters that much. But there has been a lot of, chirping about how there are now 7 FBS representatives on the committee when there's only supposed to be 5. I really don't think it matters. It's funny because one of the 7 is BYU's athletic director, whose name Tom Holmo, I think. Holmy. I'm probably butchering the pronunciation of that, but BYU's athletic director is on there. He's the West Coast Conference representative, which is not an FBS conference, but BYU is an FBS school, so that's the reason there's one of them. And I don't know why that two rolled on this time other than that it is a cycle. People weren't up in arms, you know, 5-6 years ago when we had 7 members that weren't from the FBS. So I don't think it's a big deal now that we have 7 that are. I don't want to get Kyle started on his conspiracy theories about the selection committee. But...
Well, instead of going to Kyle on it, you know, this is something we've discussed in the past many times. Is there a conspiracy? Is there a favoritism for teams that have members on the committee? Let me turn to John T. here, who's our newest. And John, do you have any thoughts on that? I know you've been following basketball for 20 years. Do you think that there is favoritism if you have a member on the committee, or do you think that the committee is pretty fair these days?
I'd like to think it's pretty fair. I mean, there's only one woman among the other 9 men on the committee, so I suppose that it's not a perfectly harmonious world, and while it'd be nice to have a perfect split of 5 and 5 from the big conferences and the small conferences, that's negligible at best. I think that anybody can be a solid representative, and it's good to have a good cross-section. I think that Jim and Kevin are going to do a fine job. I find it interesting that Kevin White as Duke AD comes in right after his team won a national title. So even though they lost a bunch of freshmen, I like their chances to squeak in as an at-large if they can't win the ACC this year.
Please don't get me to start on Duke.
John, out on a limb there.
John, if you stick around us during selection season, you'll know that Duke being a 1 seed is every year a David Griggs pet peeve.
I was actually for them last.
I'll defend David here. For the first time ever, he was for them, and I think they kind of lived up to that 1 seed in the 6 games in March, if I recall who won and who didn't win.
Right.
Let me turn to our other John, John S., who has been following the North Carolina story. One of the issues we want to get to. John, what's going on down there in Carolina?
Well, about a week or so ago, North Carolina was due to reply to the original notice of allegations they had received in response to violations to Carolina's men's basketball team as well as other sports. But what happened last week was they self-reported a couple of violations relating to women's basketball and I think men's soccer. So now I think they're waiting for a revised notice of allegations, which is supposed to give them a little bit more time to send in their reply to the NCAA and conveniently work the schedule out to a point where they may not be banned from any postseason play this year, which is the opposite of what we saw from Syracuse last year.
Yeah, one of the things that's happening here is the NCAA infractions committee and staff is they're way understaffed and they're way overworked. And I realize that North Carolina is one of the it's North Carolina, it's a headline school, it's basketball, and everybody's like, what's taking so long? Well, these people deal with all 3 divisions and all the sports. I mean, you're talking 88 sports. And what do they have? I think they have, 40 investigators now that oversee basically 2,000 schools. So it's going to be a couple of years, at least, until they really get around to ruling on this. Would it be, I've read through most of it, and all I got to say to Carolina is good luck with that. They have 5 level 1 violations. They probably could go to the tournament this year. They might go to the tournament next year. Would it be smart, I'm kind of curious to see what you all think, to go ahead and bite the bullet now? Or since they are going to be, I mean, Carolina is always strong, but they're going to be exceptionally strong this year.
I'll tell you that I really think that whether Carolina should bite the bullet this year is something they should probably decide in, like, mid-February, kind of like what Syracuse did last year. And then kicked themselves in the butt when they turned around and beat number 8 Notre Dame the next day.
At this point, there's no reason for Carolina to bite the bullet. They need to ride this and go with it as long as they can and just hope the NCAA doesn't come after them. And on a side note, I can neither confirm nor deny that I may have included myself as a CC and on the enforcement staff's emails while I was there on this issue. It was like that's neither here nor there.
Should the NCAA hire more enforcement staff?
Oh, I mean, I mean, like you said, they're understaffed and overworked. I mean, there's no doubt about that. I think, I think that they only have, correct me if I'm wrong, but I want to say 5 or 6 full-time enforcement members that are in charge of, policing 1,000 1,100 member schools, actually. So, yeah, they definitely need a bigger enforcement staff.
Yeah. North Carolina should be good this year.
Well, and the other team that did it last year also was Southern Miss, if you remember, halfway through the season. They announced that they were going to self-impose a ban while they were already in a position where they were mathematically eliminated from the Conference USA tournament, but that's neither here nor there. Yeah. Let's turn to one other issue we want to, one of the other issues we want to get to here is another in recent news, probably more of a football story really than a basketball story, but it does affect all of college sports, and that is the NLRB throwing out the Northwestern players' case trying to essentially unionize in a private institution. It's only applied to private institutions, so it did not apply to any of the public schools, but trying to unionize their football players, claiming that they are employees and entitled to collective bargaining. I know I'm the attorney here, and honestly, some of this is outside of my field of law, anyhow. But you know, some of this is a little bit complicated. But what it comes down to basically is the NLRB threw the entire case out. There is no further appeals here at this time for the Northwestern students. Although there was language left open that says in another forum, in other circumstances, there may be a basis to rebring an action such as this. But major victory for Northwestern and for the NCAA, I think, here.
Chad, this is something I was curious to hear your take on, because what struck me in reading just a summary of the decision was that they basically didn't really rule based on the merits of the case. They more or less ruled that because it was going to be potentially create an unfair advantage, because as you said, it applied only to private schools and not public schools, it could create an unfair advantage within the NCAA framework, and that's more or less why they threw the case out. They didn't really even rule on the merits of whether or not they deserve to unionize, at least from what I could tell. That was just interesting to me because it didn't seem like that they should, as much as that might be a good thing for the NCAA, I thought that was kind of strange that they were basically throwing out legal logic and just, you know, looking out for the NCAA. What was your take on that?
Well, you know, I mean, given all the defeats in the NCAA has had in court recently, I think we have to throw them a bone somewhere.
In a nutshell, what legal sense does it? What is the NLRB's concern with a competitive advantage? To me, it was just, as far as they're concerned, it's a non-issue. Now, as far as fans are concerned, as far as the NCAA is concerned, it's a huge issue. Like, if private schools were suddenly allowed to unionize and they were forced to pay their basketball players, football players, and I guess players across the board, that is a competitive advantage. But why does the NLRB care? I guess that's where I'm at with this.
And I think that's a real good point. I really think that it was the NLRB kind of saying, we don't want to go there. Let's find a way to procedurally bounce this thing. So in my opinion, at least, it was let's find a way to procedurally bounce it so we don't have to rule on the merits because we're scared to death that we're going to approve them. And if we approve them, who knows what this may end up doing for the college sports landscape going forward. John T., do you have thoughts on this whole issue?
A couple. Number one, I think that competitive imbalance can be a bad thing. We don't want the big schools always beating up on the have-nots. That being said, I don't think letting some schools unionize would be that big a deal. I mean, if the union can protect the employees, quote-unquote, from, say, voluntary summer practices, which we all know are rarely voluntary if yes. You want to be in the starting lineup, I mean, players can do what they want to do, and if some schools have voluntary practices and others are a little more mandatory, maybe it'll be a little imbalanced, but I think giving them protection for being an employee, if that's what they truly are, is not that big a deal. The thing that amused me the most was that this was a 5-0 vote, and since I live in D.C., I can assure you I've never seen 3 Democrats and 2 Republicans any time recently agree on one thing, so... Somehow it worked.
Now, do we know what schools these 5 individuals went to?
No.
It's a good point. Well, the other thing that's disturbing, going beyond the NLRB, is if you read the Northwestern document that was drafted, very little of what their complaints were or what their grievances were have been addressed. Most people think it was about getting paid, and there is the cost of living stipend that's going through. You're going to start to see that next year, probably universally. You're starting to see it this year already. That's a whole other story about how that's being implemented. But what they wanted was the 20-hour practice week to be 20 hours, not, as John T. just said, 20, basically where you have 20 official hours and then 25 voluntary hours. They wanted 20 hours. They wanted to be able to major in whatever they wanted, and that conflicts with practice time or games was not a legitimate reason for them to lose their scholarship and be told they had to major in something else. That was two of the things. They wanted medical insurance for the entire 4 years, guaranteed. Not every school has that. In fact, a lot of them don't. They wanted a doctor, like a third party, that wasn't a trainer on the team staff to decide when someone could re-enter a game after an injury, particularly a concussion. None of this has been – they haven't budged on any of it. And I don't like the idea of a union, but I like the idea that they have the opportunity to do it. I would just – as weird as this sounds – I don't want them to do it, but I want them to have the opportunity to do it, if for no other reason than to use it for leverage for things that I think they should rightfully have. They should be able to major in whatever they want. There should be a doctor that isn't on staff that makes that decision. They should have medical insurance. I mean, there was a list of like 13 or 14 things, and none of them dealt with salaries. And on top of that, none of these grievances have been addressed in any way, at least not that I've seen, from the NCAA.
And I think one of those things was also one-year scholarships versus four-year scholarships.
Yes.
I think one of our prior shows we had addressed that the Big Ten is going to start giving out four-year scholarships. Turns out the Pac-12 is also going that route as well.
Yes, schools do have the opportunity to do that now.
All right. Well, with that, let's move on to our next topic here, which is, while all those changes did not happen, these are changes that are going to be happening this year for the game on the court in college basketball. And there's actually a whole laundry list of them here. The big one that everybody's been talking about is the shot clock reduction, going from a 35-second to a 30-second shot clock, something that I originally was opposed to. I have come around. I am actually now in favor of the shorter shot clock. I think 30 seconds is as short as we could go. I don't like the NBA 24-second rule, but let's start with that. David, you seem to be shaking like you want to make a comment about the shot clock.
I prefer the 35-second shot clock. I'm not opposed to the 30-second shot clock. What I'm opposed to is the idea that shortening the shot clock will fix what's wrong with the game. The shot clock is not the problem. The physicality is the problem, and the way the game is officiated is the problem. In the 1970s and 80s, when there was no shot clock, I don't have these exact figures in front of me, but we averaged in the 70s as far as possessions per game, 77, 78. They implemented the shot clock, and again, the idea wasn't it was to avoid teams from being able to stall the game. You know, the stall ball game that I think Kentucky and Cincinnati was the most egregious, where I think the final score is 23-11 in the early 80s. 84, thank you. So, yeah, you don't want to see that. But we've gone from no shot clock with 70 upper 70s average possessions and more points to the 45-second shot clock, where we saw averages in the 70s and 60s, to the 35-second shot clock, where I think the average number of possessions, Kyle will know it off the top of his head, was in the low 60s, 62, 63. So just doing that little bit of quantitative analysis, you would conclude just on that, that lowering the shot clock actually lowers the number of possessions. Now, we know logically that that's not entirely the case, but what is the case, the reason the game is slow and that it is a mud fight and that there is no offensive flow, is because we essentially have a rugby scrum in the post now. It's a combination between a rugby scrum and a rock fight. That's why the games are ugly. And shortening the shot clock does nothing to fix the problem if you don't change how the game is officiated. That's what makes me upset.
The number of possessions per game has gone down six or seven in the past 15 years, And not coincidentally, the number of fouls called per game has also gone down about five and a half, six fouls. So what we're seeing is fewer fouls are being called, the game's more physical, and it's causing the fewer possessions, not the shot clock. It's the fact that naturally, if you have more physicality in the game, you're going to have a harder time getting a shot off, and that's what we're seeing. So shortening the shot clock is not helping until you, like David said, I can't believe I'm saying this, he makes a good point, until we get to the root of the problem, the shot clock is going to have no impact.
Go ahead, Jed.
I was just going to say that, I mean, it's what we're really saying here is that, and I kind of agree with this, that the problem is the physicality and maybe the lack of foul calls, although they tried to call more of these hand checks, call more fouls, and
it was working.
It worked for a little bit, but then the refs just gave up on it, didn't they?
They gave up on it after like 2 months, basically. And actually, it's good you bring that up, because in the list of things that they have changed for this upcoming season, one of the things they have noted is they're going to get back to the point of emphasis that they started 2 years ago with calling hand checks, but they're also going to make a point of emphasis of calling the actual elbowing and physicality in the paint, and also hand checking and elbowing cutters, bumping cutters off of screens. So they say they're going to make a point of emphasis on all of these things. We'll see how long it lasts, but it is what they need to do.
Okay, now, the downside, and there is a downside, not all medicine tastes good. We're going to see some really ugly, eye-gouging, set-your-head-on-fire games in November and December where there might be 50 and 60 fouls called. But players will adjust. If you stick with this, the game will be better again. 20 years ago, it was a much better game. It was a much more popular game. The ratings were up. Attendance was up. It wasn't this ugly rock fight that we have now. They have to stay with it, and we're going to have to endure some foul parades that admittedly suck, but I think are necessary. I'm curious to hear what John and some other people have to say about this, but I think you have to clean up the physicality if you want to improve the game.
All right, I'll mute David Griggs here for a second and let somebody else speak. but yeah, so to both of our Johns, let's start with John T. and then John S. Your thoughts on is this the solution, or is there something else wrong that needs to be done to fix the game?
I think the game is not too bad as it is. I enjoyed the Kentucky-Wisconsin semifinal and the Duke-Wisconsin final, and they were very exciting, and I think the sport is always have more scoring and more speeded up play, but I think it's okay. In terms of physicality, I believe they're moving the arc under the basket from 3 feet to 4 feet away, so hopefully that will reduce some collisions. Obviously, as David said, if the refs don't call it, that's the problem. The other things I like is any timeout within 30 seconds of a media timeout now counts as the media timeout. If you remember, like a lot of times the team will start off on a 10-1 run and the losing coach will call a timeout with like 16:05 to go in the half. And then 5 seconds after we come back, there's a foul, and then we have a media timeout. It just slows everything down. So that's taken care of. The other thing I like is instant replay for shot clock violations. Last year it was only in the last 2 minutes. This year it's the whole game long. I understand it might slow down the game in terms of if we have replays every 5 minutes or so throughout, but I like it because a shot clock violation in the first 2 minutes is equally as important as a shot clock violation in the final 2 minutes. So now we have it all game long.
Yeah, that's a great point. And there's a couple other rules that I agree with you. I'm definitely in favor of.
John brought up the timeout situation, because the last 2 minutes of that Wisconsin Arizona game 2 years ago, gosh, I think that was the longest 2 minutes I've ever seen in a college basketball game. I mean, that was like, it felt like 45 minutes long just for the last 2 minutes alone.
And the other half of it with the timeouts is that there's one less timeout per team per game now also. Total of 4 timeouts per team. One is a use it or lose in the first half, 3 of the second half. I think that combined with the regular timeout turning to media timeout can really help us speed up the how long a game takes. You know, it might be we get in under 2 hours and not one of these 2 hour and 20 minute games.
Okay, with the 16-12, 8-4 timeout with halftime, and then with the first timeout of each half being a media timeout, that is basically 45 minutes of timeout. Would it be the worst thing in the world if, because there are so many media timeouts, if there were just no timeouts for the teams, or one at the most, or at most two? I don't think we need four. That's just me. I'm a soccer.
Why don't just go through a few more of these other smaller rules that have not gotten as much attention, but you'll see them have an effect in games as the season begins. Coaches can no longer call timeouts from the bench during a live ball situation. The players have to call it, and that should have never been allowed to begin with, in my opinion.
You can't call timeout in a game if you're not in a game, in my opinion. Like, why don't they let fans call timeout?
They changed the rules a little bit on the 10-second backcourt rule as well. Still not as good but you do not get a reset at 10-second count now. If the defense knocks the ball out of bounds, if there's a held ball in the possession hours in your favor, or if there's a technical foul on the offensive team while it's in the backcourt. So you can still use a timeout, though, to get an extra 10 seconds, which I don't like. But the 10-second rule should be, by the time that shot clock is under 25, you should be in the front court, period, in my opinion.
Go ahead. I would like to make a rules proposal. John mentioned instant replay earlier. I like the standard of conclusive evidence. I also feel that after 60 seconds, if you have not concluded anything, it is by definition inconclusive, and we need to get on with the game. Like, watching the refs watch television for 5 minutes drives me insane.
I love that, you know, I'm glad David's starting this early in the year, because I'd get to hear him make this complaint like at least 30 times in a season.
Every week.
I think one exception to what David mentioned would be if the clock were to freeze during the play, and then the refs would have to have a stopwatch on hand to figure out how much time should either be added to the clock or taken from the clock, depending on how the play ran out.
Wow. Yeah, Xavier and Butler for the year.
Let's not go into that.
Let me run through a few of these other smaller changes here also, get a few comments on them. The 5-second call when you are dribbling the ball is now gone. Only when you're holding the ball. That might be a product of the shorter shot clock. We really don't need that anymore.
I don't mind that one. I think if you're dribbling, it constitutes being active. I really don't mind that one.
I actually dislike this rule change because one of the things that made the game great in the 70s and 80s was the, you know, not just the lack of physicality, but the free flowing of the game. And I mean, go back, you know, like if you go to the NCAA vault and watch some old games and watch how well the basketball moves from side to side. If we let dribblers just dribble the ball at the top of the key for 10 seconds, it takes away some of that aspect of the ball movement. And this is one rule change that they made that I actually dislike this year. I
would argue, though, Kyle, with a 30-second shot clock, it just kind of, there's not much that much time left to do that. If you take 10 seconds to get in the front court, you have one pass, and now you're already down to 15 seconds of the shot clock before you.
The problem is that we've got too much two-man basketball right now where it's just pick and roll. You know, you got one guy at the top of the key, a big man comes up, you just stand there and wait for the screen to arrive, and then, you know, at 10 seconds you go and do a, you know, two-man ball, and it's just, it takes away the incentive to, you know, to get more guys involved and have a more open offense, in my opinion.
Another change here, going back to the timeout rules, and this is one I definitely approve of. I think they should make it even shorter. You no longer get 20 seconds to substitute a player in who's fouled out. You're now down to 15 seconds, and the refs can give a warning if you're taking too long, and on the second warning, it is a technical foul.
So by 20 seconds, you mean a minute, because that's how long it took.
So now I'll be down to 30 seconds instead of a minute.
We hope.
We hope. Another one here, talk about technical fouls. A couple of things. If a player fakes a foul, being fouled when they're reviewing for a flagrant foul, they found out that was faked, it is now a technical on the faker.
Flopping technically is a technical foul. You rarely see it called, but they're supposed to call it.
Now, one other change in technicals is that what they call Class B technical fouls, hanging on the rim, delay a game, those things, are now one-shot fouls instead of two.
Whatever.
Finally, I believe this is the last one, and this is probably the biggest one of them all that nobody is talking about. Dunking in pregame and at halftime is now allowed. It is no longer a pregame technical foul.
Now, who was it that got in trouble? Was it GW about a decade ago?
In the NCAA tournament, it happened.
It happens a lot. It happened a lot. It's been my experience that players honestly just don't know that rule. Or, I mean, I'm sure they've been told 20 times, but they still don't know the rule. Baylor did it last year, didn't they? And, John, who does this sound familiar? There was one where players were dunking, the refs came out and called a technical foul, and the coach was like, well, screw it, they've already called it, keep dunking. And the school was kind of reprimanded for that. Was that Baylor that did that? I forget. But
it's such a Baylor thing to do.
Yeah. But I don't know. Like, I always thought it would be fun. I could never get anybody to go for this. If the two teams agreed to have a dunk contest before the game with the understanding that they'd both be called for technical fouls, just to entertain the fans.
Well, now they can do that. And the old rule was, well, if the refs hadn't worn out on the court yet, you could dunk away as much as you want because nobody knows. So it was kind of – it was really silly. You know, if you want to dunk during pregame and you want to, you know, try something crazy and you get hurt, well, shame on you for having done that, and you deserve it. Deserve it, is my opinion, at least.
Yeah.
Any other?
There's also one other rule change that the women's game adopted that the men's game has not adopted yet, and this is in the final minute of regulation, where if you call a timeout, you're allowed to move the ball up to half court.
I'm leaving. No.
I think we should adopt that rule in football. Chad left. We have no host. Yeah. I think we should adopt that rule in football. If you call timeout, you're allowed to move the ball instantly 50 yards down the field. Why? It just baffles me. The NBA does this. How can, like, if you call timeout, why are you allowed to start the game at the other end of the court?
That is the dumbest rule from the NBA. If the NCAA even thinking about it, is just idiocy, in my opinion.
It's timeout grants you warp zone thing, like Mario Brothers. You can just warp ahead.
Why are the rules different in the final 2 minutes of the game? Should the rules be the same for all 40 minutes?
I don't like the rule, but it does make the end of games more exciting with the NBA because you're never out of it, especially if you've got a timeout left, you're down 4 points.
As it would with football.
It does. I mean, it keeps you in the game. It keeps people more interested in the end game situations.
Yeah, heaven forbid we should have a holy mackerel moment or a Christian Leitner moment, because we know that would never happen under such a proposed rule.
Yeah. I don't know. John, what do you think of that rule? Well, if the women do it, the men will do it within a year or two. Because I think the rules committee looks at the women and then just copies them. Well, they did. I mean, they are. Like, the new practice rules...
Honestly, if you look at some of the rules that have been going in, they're starting to copy the NBA a lot more. I think you're going to see standardization of the rules in the next 10 years.
Yeah, well, I mean, with the adjustments they made to practice at the start of the season with the 30-second shot clock, I don't know. And women generally do things better than we do, but this is not one of those things.
John T, I guess, do you have thoughts on the rule?
The one rule I wanted to comment on was the one you mentioned with the 5-second call. And to be honest, I do kind of like it because I think it rewards teams just like we rewarded teams for the 10-second rule. So think about a pressing team like Louisville. If you can hold the other team, your opponent, in the backcourt for 9 seconds and then knock the ball away, then they have 1 second to get it over. So your defense is rewarded by not giving them another 10 seconds.
Absolutely.
Consequently, if the team is able to get the ball into the front court and has a good point guard, then their reward for having the point guard be able to dribble around and not get stuck in the corner and trapped and try to get rid of it and call a timeout or something is his reward, much like the defense is rewarded for pressing, is that the offense is rewarded for not having a 5-second rule called. So I actually do like that rule.
Well, let me turn to the subject now. Are any rules that we think should be changed that were not? And
60-second television reviews.
Well, besides the 60-second television review, I've been calling for this for years. I still don't understand it. Why does the NCAA believe that a referee cannot throw up a ball to do a jump ball when there's a held ball possession? Why do we have that stupid possession arrow? Anyone?
I'm not as bothered by it as most people. I understand why people are bothered. It just doesn't. As long as we're restarting the game quickly, I just don't care.
But also flashing back to another rollback, and I think it was 98-99, where if the defense forced a tie-up, they would automatically be granted the ball, but would only use that possession arrow if it truly was a disputed jump ball. I don't think we're going to go back to that again, though.
Okay, Chad, just to be clear, I agree with you that that should be the rule, but it isn't at the top of my list of things I'd like to see changed.
Well, I know you want to see the time, the review time change.
Yes, have I mentioned that? I would like to see a limit of 60 seconds on review. I don't know if I've mentioned that.
Any others that you want to see changed?
Yes, I would like to see a limit of 60 seconds.
Okay. How about Kyle? You got any rules you want to see changed?
I mean, at this point, I've kind of decided I would like to see the three-point line move back NBA distance. I still think that's something that they've been teetering with. They've talked about moving it back even more. I know they moved it back six inches a few years back, and they're looking at moving it back more. I'd like to just go ahead and say let's do NBA distance, because I think last year the number of attempts or percentage of attempts of overall field goals for three-pointers were at an all-time high. So I say just go all the way, go to NBA distance and get it over with.
How about John T? Any rule changes you're thinking of?
Not that one.
Not so much for the game. I'd love them to fix some recruiting rules. It seems like it's a little out of control here and there. I think they've reined it in from the past, but it's still bad, and it might get worse unless we nip it in the bud.
And our other John, John S.
Nope, can't think of any other rule changes at this point other than what's already been discussed.
And how come nobody mentioned the most important one of all? Shouldn't a 64-team tournament have 64 teams in it?
Yes. I figured we would get to that later. But
I guess that's for the end of the season, and we haven't even started it yet.
The economy to have the first four.
Okay, a beginning of the season rule, since, and again, this has nothing, I think closed scrimmages should be allowed but not required. If you want to play another Div 1 team in your exhibition game and open it up, you should be able to. If you don't want to open it up, you shouldn't have to. But the idea that it has to be a closed scrimmage if you're playing another Div 1 school is absurd to me.
Hey, Chad, if we want to have a discussion on rule changes, we should just go back to NCAA headquarters, because they've got a whole mail bin devoted to David Griggs' mail. He sends about 1,000 letters every week.
Well, and 900 of them were about the replay rules.
Well, I can guarantee you, Kyle, that David Griggs was the only person complaining about exhibition college basketball games.
That's probably true.
Well, why can't you open it? That makes no... Well, I know the reason. They don't want... Well, what they say is that they don't want them to be high-pressure events. What it really is that they don't want teams to have an unfair advantage in giving them extra home games. But you're allowed to schedule Division II and III in NAIA schools, which is an extra home game. So it makes it – they're just dumb.
I have a quick question for everybody.
Okay.
Did UCLA have any closed scrimmages last year? Because I'm still trying to figure out how they were able to impress the selection committee to get in.
Actually, this is a rule change that happened this year. Thanks for mentioning this, John. Actually, apparently, the way that the NCAA Tournament Selection Committee was picking their teams was the first four were the last four teams that they selected to put into the field chronologically in time. So the last four teams that got in, if they didn't get in until Saturday morning, those are the first four teams, even if on their S-curve they would have been ranked – they would have moved up above some of the teams that they'd already put in. So UCLA was the fifth to last team to get in. So that's why UCLA not only got in but avoided the first four last year. Starting this year, They will do a full S curve of all the a full C list of all the teams, including the last four teams put in, and a team that gets voted in fifth or sixth in the end can still end up can be in the first four, which I never knew they even did that way.
It wasn't where you were on the S curve. It was when you were voted into the field that determined whether or not you were in the first four.
Which makes no sense, but team seasons end at different times while the committee is in the room because of conference tournaments. It made no sense. So a team that plays its way in by making it to the A-10 championship game on Sunday doesn't get any extra credit for that and still stuck in the first four because they need an at-large in one of the last four teams that gets in.
Hey, but they got
a shout out had UConn won the American tournament last year.
Yeah, it would have been interesting.
With that, any other final thoughts from anyone?
I just wanted to give a recruiting shout out. I always think that a lot of people would concur that John Calipari is the best college basketball recruiter now and maybe ever. But when you think about Krzyzewski, and I know that the Duke Rants are starting early this year, this time last year he had five McDonald's All-Americans amongst many others, Justice Winslow, Tyus Jones, Jahlil Okafor, Rashid Suleiman, and Quinn Cook. All five are gone, yet he's still going to have seven on his team this year, most in America. They are a legitimate threat to repeat.
Well, I like their chances of repeating more than anyone else.
And if they need any help, they do have some help in the selection committee room.
Right. Right. I don't think anyone else other than Duke has any shot at repeating this year.
Wise words from Mr. Griggs.
Yes.
I know of a school 80 miles south of where I am that may beg to differ on that.
How the hell is Kentucky going to repeat? They didn't win.
Kyle, any final thoughts from you?
No, I mean, I beg to differ on the Duke having a legitimate chance of repeating, but that's another discussion for another day, so I'll just leave it at that.
Well, I'm going to hold off on that as well. Quite honestly, I have not taken a serious look at teams' chances come for this upcoming season yet, and probably still a little too early as we're getting schedules and getting rosters finalized, but that will be coming up in a couple months. We're not that far away from the start of the season. And on that note, I guess for myself, for Kyle, for John T., John S., and for the puppet down there, I'm Chad Sherwood, and have a great night, everybody. We'll talk to you again real soon.